Okay, let's say our opening prayer, as we always do. This is Mother's Prayer. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Beloved Jesus Christ, Blessed Master, Dearest Mother, Beloved David, Saints and Sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only King, reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Peace, bliss, amen. Play a short song from Bhima while we meditate.
That I might crucify the lie that binds me, given me a flower that I might realize the light that shines in me. Cross that I might crucify the lie that binds me, given me a flower that I might realize the light that shines in me.
We've took quite a while to get through chapter 3. And I'd like to read what I wrote. I was mulling this over quite a bit lately. And so this is the takeaways I find from Holy Science that I put into an article in the new journal, which has come out. It's online now, too, and it'll be in the mail here pretty soon. I just put everything in the mail yesterday, I think it was. So you should get it soon. Poor Canadians, they're... you guys are having a strike up there, and so I got to the post office with all the stuff to go to Canada, and or to all of the stuff, and it went fine. And then when I got to the bulk of Canadian stuff, he said they won't even accept it, the Canadians have asked the U.S. post office not to accept stuff. So he had me send it back. I wonder if it had been a single mail, it may have gone through, but he told me to come back after the strike. So we'll try to get them up to you in some other way. But anyway, these are the takeaways that I still think a lot about with regard to this book. And it seems to have been, this is one of the best times I've had reading it. And, you know, it's a cumulative thing. So, and I just want to go through, these are just little synopses of the different chapters, what they all do and how he puts this book together. I have more admiring of it as time goes on. So chapter 1 is the gospel. The author starts from the single fact about existence, that there's only God and he is existence itself. The very existence that we share in and that we are part of and our bodies are made from. He shows us the basic building blocks of our bodily existences. The power of Shakti, that is the source of God's power in all experience. That time and space are intrinsically woven into life and the material aspect of the three-tiered realm. I realize material aspect isn't quite right because that has more to do, that word has to do with the body, the physical plane, but there are things in the first chapter in which he talks about the Anu, or the particles, the idea of the atom. And so that is the material realm I meant by that. Material aspect of all three tiers, of all three realms. And then chapter 2, he talks about the goal. Now, he's talking about where we're going. This chapter by itself is a complete Chai teaching and is a distillation of the gifts of philosophy and science about our lives in God's universe. If one were to only read this chapter, it would suffice to build a foundation to understand all of yoga, all of the great teachings of India. We learn about the whole lofty goal of salvation from this realm. And through seeking God realization, and that is too attainable, yet is hidden from our conscious minds. Sri Yukteswar teaches us that we must align our minds with the understanding that to know God is the way. And then chapter 3 is called The Procedure. This chapter is the longest and the most detailed. It describes the steps that we must take to gain realization. In chapter 1, Sri Yukteswar starts from the top at the source, and in this chapter, he explains things from the ground and points the light of his knowledge upwards to aid us to navigate in the world that we inhabit. But having given us the true grounding in chapter 1, we have some inkling of what we are about. We are taught a very subtle thing with his discussion of the five sheaths that cover every particle of creation. These sheaths are unwrapped through the evolution of every soul in every particle. He shows us we humans have progressed through time, and we find that we are already most of the way home to God, because human souls start with three of the sheaths removed. God and time brought us to this point. As humans, we learn to use our consciousness to guide the removal of the next two sheaths, to gain a state of high realization, and then to gain the highest state, that of Paramukta or Sahaja Samadhi. And then chapter 4 is the revelation. Here Sri Yukteswar reviews in short form what is learned in chapter 3 with the goal clearly set before us and how the steps to God make it possible to attain him. He also restates the necessity of gaining the protection of a Satguru, and he exhorts us to diligently put to practice all of the teachings of the Satguru once you are in his charge. He will teach you with sound and light to guide you on your way back to your true self. And finally, the conclusion, which we'll probably get to next time. All becomes clear with true revelation. He reminds us that it all starts with the love from the heart, that this will guide us to God and Guru regardless of religion or method of cultivating this love. With sufficient development gained from the revelatory experience, we are taught we can merge in God's self by sacrificing our little self. Sri Yukteswar ends with a heartfelt plea to use our time well on this earth. So we'll go with, we'll start chapter 4. I assume you can all see it on the screen if you've got your screen open. And so, chapter 4, the revelation, starting with paragraph 1. Adeptship is attainable by the purification of the body in all respects. Purification of the material body can be affected by things generated along with it by nature. That of the electric body by patience in all circumstances, and that of the magnetic body, chitta, by the regulation of the breath, which is called mantra, the purifier of the mind. The process of how purifications can be effected may be learned at the feet of the divine personages who witness light and bear testimony of the Christ consciousness. Interesting that he uses that term. By culture of the regulation of the breath as directed by the spiritual preceptor, Satguru, the holy word, pranava or shabda, appears by itself or becomes audible. When this holy word, pranava or shabda, appears, mantra, the breath, becomes regulated and checks the decay of the material body. The pranava appears in different forms at the different stages of advancement according to the purification of the heart, citta. It has already been explained what Satguru is and how to keep the company thereof. Man, when endowed with the heavenly gift of pure love, naturally becomes disposed to avoid the company of what is asat and to keep the company of what has been described as sat. By affectionately keeping the company of sat, he may be fortunate enough to please one who may kindly stand to him as his Satguru or spiritual preceptor. By keeping his godlike company, there goes an inclination, pravritti, in the disciple's heart to save himself from the creation of darkness, maya, and he becomes prabhartaka, however, an initiate in the practices of yama and niyama, the ascetic forbearance and observance necessary to obtain salvation. It may be remembered that by culture of yama and niyama, the 8 meannesses vanish from the human heart and our magnanimity comes in. It is at this stage that man becomes fit for the practice of ascetic posture, etc. The process is pointed out by his Satguru to attain salvation. When he continues to practice the processes so pointed out to him, he becomes a sadhaka or disciple. On a reference to chapter 3, it will be found how a disciple, while passing through the different stages, becomes able to conceive the different objects of creation in his heart, and how he gradually advances to the state of meditation, and ultimately, by concentrating his attention to the sensorium, he perceives the peculiar sound, pranava shabda, the holy word, when the heart becomes divine, and the ego, ahankara, or the son of man, becomes merged or baptized in the stream thereof, and the disciple becomes siddha, an adept, a divine personage. In the state of baptism, bhakti yoga, surat shabda yoga, man repents and withdraws his self from the external world of gross matters, the bhuloka, and enters into the internal one of fine matter, the bhuvarloka, where he perceives the manifestation of spirit, the true light, like 7 stars in 7 centers, or conspicuous places, which have been compared to 7 golden night candlesticks. These stars, being the manifestation of true light, the spirit, are called angels or rishis, which appear one after another in the right hand of the Son of Man, i.e. in his right way to the divinity. The 7 golden candlesticks are called the 7 churches, patals, the 7 conspicuous places in the body, known as brain, the Sahasrara, medulla oblongata, the Ajna chakra, and 5 other centers, namely cervical, the Shuddha, dorsal, Anahata, lumbar, Manipur, sacral, Svadhisthana, and coccygeal, Muladhara. Muladhara, where the spirit becomes manifested. Through these seven centers or churches, the ego or son of man passes towards the divinity. See Revelations 1, 12, and 13, 16, and 20, and then 2, 1. And being turned, I saw seven golden candlesticks, and in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man, and he had in his right hand seven stars. The mystery of the seven stars which thou sawest in my right hand, and the seven golden candlesticks. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven candlesticks which thou sawest are the seven churches. These things saith he that holdeth the sun, that holdeth the seven stars in his right hand, who walketh in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. In this state of baptism, Bhakti Yoga or Surat Shabda Yoga, the ego, Surat, the Son of Man, gradually passing through the seven places mentioned above, acquires the knowledge thereof, and when he thus completes the journey through the whole of these regions, he understands the true nature of the universe. Withdrawing his self from Bhuvarloka, the fine material creation, he enters into Swarloka, the source of all matters, fine and gross. There he perceives the luminous astral form around his heart atom, the throne of spirit, the creator, provided with five electricities and with two poles, mind and intelligence, of seven different colors, as in rainbows. In this sphere of electricities, mind and intelligence, the source of all objects of senses and of organs for their enjoyment, man becomes perfectly satisfied with being in possession of all objects of his desires and acquires a complete knowledge thereof. Hence the astral form aforesaid, with its electricities and poles, the seven parts thereof, has been described as a sealed casket of knowledge, a book with seven seals. See Revelations 5, 1 and 4, 3. And I saw in the right hand of him that sat on the throne a book written within and on the backside sealed with seven seals. And there was a rainbow round about the throne. You'll notice that he includes things he's talked about before. The Son of Man, the lokas, and the spheres of it, influence. So I see I just have this last bit here to finish. So we'll go ahead and read it. We'll go through it again. The Maharloka, the place of magnet, as explained before, is the Brahmarandra, or Dasam Dwara, the door between two creations, material and spiritual. When Ego, the Son of Man, comes to the door, he comprehends the spiritual light and becomes baptized therein. And passing through this door, he comes above the ideal creation of darkness, Maya, and entering into the spiritual world, receives the true light and becomes the Son of God. Thus man, being the Son of God, overcomes all bondage of darkness, Maya, and becomes possessed of all Aisharyas, the ascetic majesties. These Aisharyas, I wonder if that's Yogacharya Aisharya, might be, so look that up. These Aisharyas are of eight sorts, namely anima, the power of making one's body or anything else as small as he likes, even as an atom, anu. Mahima, the power of magnifying or making one's body, or anything else, mahat, as large as he likes. Lagima, the power of making one's body or anything else, lagu, as light as he likes. And Garima, the power of making one's body or anything else, guru, as heavy as he likes. Prapti, the power of apti, obtaining anything he likes. Basitwa, the power of basha, namely bringing anything under control. And prakamya, the power of satisfying all desires, comma, by irresistible will force. And ishitwa, the power of becoming isha, lord over everything. See John 14:12. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that believeth on me, the works that I do shall he do also, and greater works than these shall he do, because I go unto my Father. Thus man being possessed of Aisharyas, the ascetic majesties aforesaid, fully comprehends the eternal spirit, the Father, the only real substance, as unit, the perfect whole, and his self as nothing but a mere idea, resting on a fragment of the spiritual light thereof. Man, thus comprehending, abandons altogether the vain idea of the separate existence of his own self and becomes unified with him, the eternal spirit, God the Father. This unification with God is Kaivalya, the ultimate object of this treatise. See Revelations 3:21. To him that overcometh will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne. It's quite beautiful. So he says this is the goal, this last paragraph. Man being possessed of Acharyas, the ascetic majesties aforesaid, fully comprehends the eternal spirit, the Father, the only real substance as a unit, as a perfect whole. This is the notion, this is the idea that God is one and that we are all, there is only one. And he says, man knows that his self has nothing but a mere idea resting on a fragment of the spiritual light thereof. Man thus comprehending, abandons altogether the vain idea of the separate existence of his own self and becomes unified with him, the eternal spirit, God the Father. This unification with God is Kaivalya, the ultimate object of this treatise. You know, in reading this, I thought of this story that I think I read it somewhere, but may have heard it from Rom Hamilton, I'm not sure. So the devotees were going to follow after Ma, Anandamayi Ma, when she was leaving the ashram and going somewhere. They never knew where. They just started getting in their cars and following her. And they were following very closely and maybe being a little bit dangerous, as I remember the story, and in their driving, trying to catch up with her. And Ma stopped the car, and Ma rolled her window down and put her finger out. And then all of a sudden, their car wouldn't start. They couldn't get it to start. And so Ma's car took off, going where they were going. And then a few minutes later, they could start the car and away they went. So you think, well, how did she do that? Well, this is what this power that he's talking about here in these last pages. Prapti, the power of Apya, obtaining anything he likes. And then the power of Vasya Apasitva, number 6, bringing anything under control. You know, when Jesus cures someone and masters do, we saw in the autobiography of Yogi, the master talked about that quite a bit, that the things are done without knowledge needed to take care of these things. A great master doesn't have to be a mechanic to know to twiddle this knob or to tighten this or screw or any of these things. It is that his will is supreme. And will doesn't need to have direct knowledge of how to do things, only to have the will to do it. And the will and intellect is intelligence. It's all intelligent in itself, down to the smallest atom. And so this will can be will agree to, once it's aligned with a great master, will be able to do whatever he wants to do. Fly. Swami Keshavananda went to England for a woman's, well, Lahiri Maharshi has the story, that's the better story, where he knew that the man was worried about his wife. And so Lahiri Maharshi traveled to England and appeared to her and asked, and either cured her, but came back with the story that she was fine and she's writing him a letter. And when the letter came, she relayed everything that had happened, that he had said happened. She had been cured and she was better, and she's coming to India. And she got to India, she saw the Lahiri Maharshi and she realized that's who it was who had come to her. There's a story around Keshavananda similar. And now I can't remember because I've just gotten it confused with the Lahiri Maharshi one. Anyone know that story, please pipe up. It's fine. But these things that masters do, walking on water, all of this. And, you know, the Muslims, I've said this before, they have this idea that gravity doesn't really exist in the way that we think of it as a force. an uncomprehending force, an unintelligent force. They say that in scientific terms, it's not gravity. It is the will of Allah. It's the will of God that does everything, that makes everything follow. And if it follows in a mathematically understandable way, then that's fine. Mathematics is fine, but it's not what's going on. It is the will of God. All is the will of God. I remember Mother really surprised me when she said that when it says that God is omnipotent, what that means is that he's the only force, not just that he's the greatest force. Omnipotent means something more profound, and she says it that way. This is proof. These terms that we think we are approximating by saying omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent. These things mean, omni means, ultimately really just means all, or only. So he's the only power, he's the only receiver of things for knowledge, omniscient, and he is the only presence. So it isn't that he exists everywhere the way, as a rider along with each molecule. He is, his body is made up, makes up the universe, and he exists in each of these cells. Years ago, I noticed the combination, the similarity of the names atom, avidya, and Adam, as in Adam and Eve. I think I have that right. I'm trying to think if there was other ones, but anyway, that these are all talking about the same thing. Adam wasn't the first. He's the only. And we partake in that. We are part of that. We are being fooled to think that this world exists of its own, that it's a wind-up toy, and it has a separate existence. It does not. Not a separate existence. The only separate existence, the only thing separate, whatever that means. There is only one thing, and it's not separate from anything except as a way of thinking back to our source. So let's So he talks about here we are in chapter 4, the first paragraphs. He talks about the purification of the body. And he talks about that in the first two chapters. And this is a summary, kind of a recapitulation of all of the things in the previous chapter. Wretched body by patience. Notice too, this occurs to me now, that he starts with saying there is only one, and it's only one exists, one source, one essence, and that's Sat. And here at the very last chapter, he says, man being possessed of the Sayas, the ascetic majesties, fully comprehends the eternal spirit, the Father, the only real substance as unit, the perfect whole, and his self is nothing but a mere idea, resting on a fragment of the spiritual light. Man thus comprehending abandons altogether the vain idea of his separate existence and becomes unified with him, the eternal spirit, God the Father. This is really, really high stuff. It sounds academic and scientific to a certain extent. But it is such clarity in his own mind on how this is all put together. These things are good to know about. This book is good to know about because we can all point to it. We can all review it if we get to that point. If we have these experiences, will come. We can find confirmation with this type of teaching for what we are going through. So this is a valuable book as a reference to see what, as we go through things, it is not a recipe in the sense that you can do all these things and, you know, you can just follow this as a rules. He is saying that those only comes to you when you have a guru. That's what you should do. And then you can have the knowledge of what that he's speaking from. And that is taught by the Indians in their great philosophies. It's really quite amazing how mature it is. And then in the West, it's all hidden with allegory and parables. And that is the way it's taught, so that only people who have attained those spiritual states can refer to the Bible and see something there, as Mother did, and see the great truth that's there hidden, latent in the Bible and other scriptures as well. But this one here is written, though it's short, to be comprehensive. It's a great gift. And he says, a culture of regulation of the breath. So when I was in seminary, the things that we were taught, you know, it was only there 2 years of high school, but it's so good grounding that we got. I just had a wonderful education there. And they really wanted to ground us in the basic things. And so they taught us early on at a retreat that it's meditation and inner contemplation on God. It's really, really valuable, and really what is the true place that we should aspire to. You know, as priests, they're thinking, you know, well, you need to know about these things for your own self, but also you need to teach people. And so people will be going through different states and be going through different experiences, and you have to have some knowledge. But anyway, the three steps there were that you have concentration. You'll see it's similar to what Sri Yukteswar says here. You have, first of all, concentration. You learn to concentrate the mind and to focus into less, smaller and fine things. And then to concentrate, but learn to concentrate and stay on topic and say focused, perhaps is a good word too, on a single thing. So if it is a flame or whatever your guru is, the guru's feet, it can be pretty much anything. And I have more to say on that, but because that's really important, but let me just finish this thought. The concentration is first, then you meditate. Meditation is the state where you sit and rest in God. And you, by concentration, you've strengthened the mind to be able to sit and not be distracted. And meditation is the practice of patience and faith and hope and love. It is this sitting in awareness of God. And then the final state they talk about in the Catholic realms, in the monks, in the monasteries, is what they call contemplation. Now, we know this as samadhi. It's absorption in God. But one way it was explained is that when the practice takes you up, that's contemplation. When the practice takes you up and you can't think of anything, you can't even function in your regular world, you have difficulties when you get into these high states, even coming in. Normally we have to fight to get into this realm. And this realm, when it absorbs you, takes you to a point where you are satisfied there. And you have to come down to the world because of duties, and the body is so insistent it will eventually require it. But also you have a job to do here. We all have things to do here. So, contemplation. I've always thought that was an odd thing, because we think of it the way we use that term. It's almost like concentration. Concentration. But no, it's a special meaning. It's a philosophical meaning or a religious meaning. Contemplation is that which takes you up, absorbs you. These higher teachings, these people know about these things. They're taught these things. I think, though, that they're feeding so much pablum to babies, and the children are grown. They need real food, and this is where Master has come to this world, come to the West, to give real food. And Mother's contribution will be this bridge to the biblical people who are open to, you know, I think that David and I talked about this a lot, that Christians will come to the point where they have these experiences and the body starts acting up. And they won't know about Kundalini. And so it's good to know that this is not just Kundalini in the way they think of it academically and that's what the yogis in India do. No, no, no. This happens to Christian saints. It happens to anybody in the world. This is to do with the body and this the reality that we inhabit. So I was going to look it up and I forgot to do this, so bear with me. I don't think I'll look it up now, but I wanted to point out that Sri Yukteswar says that, and if you remember, I read this last time, it doesn't matter what you worship. For the adept, the adept knows not to look at anything outside and worship it. That's the way we're being taught, but Sri Yukteswar makes a very, very important point. He leaves it open that each doorway that you see to gain access to the religious, to the spiritual experience is not to be, he even says, things that even are disgusting to other people or, you know, really resisted and made fun of by other people, that is, we are not to take judgment on that. These things can be a figure on this altar, can be a light, can be a candle, can be a candlestick, can be a lingam. Those things are doorways. He's insisting. And it's a righteous way. Because once the attainment occurs, you may enter a lifetime where that is what's done by your family, your people. And it will get you all the way. It will take you to the higher realm eventually. But the concentration is what makes things holy. This is what I maintain about these great cathedrals and these great holy spots on the earth. They're made holy by the people who would visit them. They're made holy. Now, a great master who visits, of course, instills even more. But what does he instill it in? Does he instill it into the physical? I wonder. I think there's a talk of that. There must be some truth to it. But he's also a psychic beacon on the psychic level, that whenever anyone comes into a building and sees it in the same way that someone saw it 300 years ago, that that person draws all the thoughts and all the individuals resonating with that. This is where it's quite beautiful. And that's what we're feeling. Are we feeling it emanating from the rocks of the cathedral? Or are we cohabiting? Remember, time is an illusion. It's part of the elusive thing. So the idea that we are seeing it in, 2024 and they saw it in the 1600s is really not important. What's important is what we're seeing. And the similarity of that time, and what it pulls from you, and what you give to the experience, and the experience that God grants people in these holy sites. You just cannot ignore this testimony that people give to experiences in God. These things are great. They're great. They're really the very fruit of what spiritual teachings are hoping for. And it will be grueling. It will be confusing. And bishops and archbishops and popes and cardinals may not understand it. And they may deal with many mentally ill people. So there's nothing wrong with anybody opposing it or having that experience. It's simply to have the patience to get through it and resolve it. The great thing about proper Stoics is that they can endure they can have patience. Points out that by affectionately keeping the company of Sat, he may be fortunate enough to please one who may kindly stand to him as his Satguru or spiritual preceptor. By keeping his godlike company, there grows an inclination in the disciple's heart to save himself from the creation of darkness, and he becomes an initiate in the practices of Yama and Niyama, the ascetic forbearance and observance necessary to obtain salvation. Ascetic. This is patience. This is willing to go through all things in forbearance and in observance. This is the meditation side. It may be remembered that by the culture of Yama and Niyama, the eight meannesses vanish from the human heart, and magnanimity comes in. It is at this stage that man becomes fit for the practice of ascetic posture. The process is pointed out by his Satguru to attain salvation. When he continues to practice the processes so pointed out to him, he becomes a sadhaka, or disciple. On a reference to chapter 3, it will be found how a disciple, while passing through the different stages, becomes able to conceive the different objects of creation in his heart, and how he gradually advances to the state of meditation, and ultimately by concentrating his attention to the sensorium. Now, this is a term that he uses, and we should talk about it. He perceives the peculiar sound, the Om, the holy word, when the heart becomes divine and the ego, or the Son of Man, becomes merged or baptized in the stream thereof, and the disciple becomes Siddha, an adept of a divine personage. In the state of baptism, man repents and withdraws his self from the external world of gross matters and enters into the internal one of fine matter, where he perceives the manifestation of spirit, the true light, like seven stars in seven centers or conspicuous places, which have been compared to seven golden candlesticks. These stars, being the manifestation of true light, the spirit, are called angels or rishis, which appear one after another in the right hand of the Son of Man. In his right way to the divinity, the seven golden candlesticks are called the seven churches, petals, which is the word from petal, as in thousand-petaled, lotus of the brain, of the mind, brain. The seven conspicuous places in the body known as brain, the sahasrara, medulla oblongata, the five other centers, that's the cervical, dorsal, lumbar, sacral, and coccygeal. Now, so we're all told that these places in the body have a special light that emanates from them. That's why they are known. And this is what St. John is talking about in Revelations. This turning on your inner spiral staircase, where you can view, you can look back into the reality of your own body and see these things light up. This turning allows this to happen. You separate yourself slightly from the body, your consciousness slightly, and you can see the body. These lights are tremendous lights, and you can perceive that light. It will reflect. If it comes from your own body, you can see it in a mirror. Others can see it with sufficient consciousness.
And David, David described having that experience.
What's that?
David described having that experience.
Michelle, I can't hear you very well. Have I got mine turned down?
Yeah, David.
I can barely. You're like a voice crying in the wilderness. Yeah, I can barely hear you. I'm trying to turn it up, but.
David described having this experience.
Yes, right. Right, he did. Mm-hmm. It's what St. John is talking about. And now here he says, over here on the left page here, and being turned, I saw seven golden candlesticks. And in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man, and he had in his right hand seven stars. The mystery of the seven stars which thou sawest in my right hand and the seven golden candlesticks. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven candlesticks which thou sawest are the seven churches.
Do you have any sense of that, Larry? The seven stars in the hand as the angels versus the seven churches seems like it's a different experience.
You know, I think that there's a self-luminous aspect to each of them, and that's this, the angels and that. And Sri Yukteswar says above there, he says, he says, manifestation of spirit, the true light like seven stars and seven centers. So the seven centers are the spinal centers that we've been taught. Or conspicuous places which have been compared to seven golden candlesticks. They're conspicuous places on the body. They are places, and so that's the candlestick. The light that comes from the candles on there, I think, is go ahead.
The churches are perhaps the physical center, and the angels are the
centers. I think it's the light that comes from them. The energy, he calls them powerhouses also. So power, light, energy, all are the same thing. And you often can't see the difference between
right. The right-handed aspect of it.
That's interesting
also,
too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's usually the positive of the centers.
Mm-hmm.
But the seventh center doesn't have a polarity, so.
Well, I mean, it's a confluence of two things, though. I see what you're saying, but there is a... You know, the 14 stations of the cross have to do with that. In this Christian or the Catholic way of looking at it. So they mean... See, the way that we first learned it, I remember learning it from Mother, was, you know, the 12, Last Supper is the 12 disciples, and that Jesus was the realized. So he brings the threads into and forms a unit. But there's an aspect of duality, because duality comes from that higher realm. But it's completely resolved, so you feel no duality, because they have been buried. They've come up and have been buried in that top chakra. So I'm resistant saying that there is no duality, there's no polarity. I understand you're right to think that way, and I'm sure, I think David talked that way, and that may be what you're saying, but in reality, it is depicted also as a resolution of the duality into, grounded into the seventh chakra. But anyway, there's Jesus being the 13th person in the Last Supper. That is a representing... You know, it's funny, it happens before his crucifixion, doesn't it? And he doesn't ascend until later and all that. So it's complicated, the stories that are told and the way that they, you know, that they, the parable is told to speak to higher things. But Jesus came as a divine being. So he plays the role of the 13th, of the top chakra. These, you know, it's funny, we probably get too tied up in the graphical aspects of things. I certainly do. And so we need to look at the parables in the best light. And also, oftentimes there's experiences that will explain some of these things. So you can ask God about it. Passing through this Svarloka, let's go back to, I want to know where. Well, that's chapter 3, that's why I'm having trouble. Passing through this Svarloka, the Son of Man comes to Maharloka, the place of magnet of which the ideas of manifestation, time, space, and particle are the four component parts. Now again, this is a recapitulation of the first chapter, but we're coming at it backwards. He starts with one, shows the breakdown, and then he comes back to the goal, what is this one called? The revelation. And that the revelation is that we see these things being true. That's from chapter 1. The Son of Man comes to Maharloka, the place of magnet of which the ideas of manifestation, time, space, and particle are the four component parts. As has been already mentioned in chapter 1, this Maharloka represents avidya, the ignorance, which produces the idea of separate existence of self, and is the source of ego, the Son of Man. Thus man, being the offspring of ignorance, and the ignorance being represented by the four ideas aforesaid, these ideas are called the four manus, the origins or sources of man. Now isn't that interesting? Now Sri Yukteswar says this in a different way than Papa. Papa says that man is God playing the fool. And Papa had a sense of humor. And he had a way of teaching. And that's a very good way to teach exactly what Sri Yukteswar is saying. This man, being the offspring of ignorance, and the ignorance being represented by the four ideas aforesaid, these ideas are called the four manus, the origins or sources of man. Let's take some contemplation. The Maharloka, the place of magnet, as explained before, is the Brahma Randra, or the door between two creations. I got trouble with my glasses. Between two creations, material and spiritual. When ego, the Son of Man, comes to the door, he comprehends the spiritual light and becomes baptized therein. And passing through this door, he comes above the ideal creation of darkness, and entering into the spiritual world, receives the true light and becomes the Son of God. Thus man, being the Son of God, overcomes all bondage of darkness and becomes possessed of all Acharyas. I have to look that word up. The ascetic majesties, these Acharyas are of eight sorts. So, all the powers that come to you. And this, of course, many people can... is this a place from which you cannot fall? I don't know. This takes more study, I think, to know that's what he's saying. It sounds like that's what he's saying. He has overcome all bondage of darkness, he says. It sounds like he has attained a state from which he cannot fall. But these powers are ascetic majesties. So ascetic people who are yogis who can do a certain ascetic things can gain some of these powers, probably. This is an area that would be fruitful to study in more detail. Because if they have some powers, it doesn't mean they have them all. Once you attain the state that he's talking about, he says you are given them all. The state that Mother attained, she said that she just gave everything over to God, and that it was her will to do God's will. So these powers may have been latent in Mother, but she never used them, or if she did use them, she never advertised it. So many things mysterious about Mother's life, as with David's. Thus, man, being possessed of Asharya's, the ascetic majesties aforesaid, fully comprehends the eternal spirit, the Father, the only real substance as a unit, the perfect whole, and his self as nothing but a mere idea. Anyway, there's a lot there. Really well said, too. Now, one thing we do know is the 1920 version is slightly different than the 1940. This is the 1949 edition. Now, Master may have written this. He may well have edited it for his own master because he knew English language and at least Western ideas and more contemporaneously up to date with the ideas. This was written in 1894, and so it may have been changes that were made were different. Were done by Master, we have some reason to believe. Now, this is also published in Bengal, so we don't know exactly its provenance, but at least it was given, you know, during the time Master was alive. And so it's generally very close to where we're talking. Now, the 1920 version must have been done by Sri Yukteswar because it was the year that Master left India. And so he had it published in different, I'm sure in 1894 he clearly had it published in some form. And so it'd be good to have all the versions, of course, as we are all like to be collectors of spiritual materialism. But it would be nice to see how it was expressed in 1894 exactly. But the 1920 version is slightly different from what I've been told. And now I have a copy of that, and I'm going to be converting it to text and getting it made similar to this one. And then I can do a comparison more easily. Lots of work. I'm having trouble with just the making all this text with the Sanskrit. Now, I don't know why that Sanskrit is not working. Yeah. Oh, I see. That's because this is a PDF. Yes. Anyway, this Sanskrit is also a real lot of work because I was told through some Indian people who did the translations for me or the they're the ones who gave me the script to make these characters. And they said this, that Sri Yukteswar, I sent them copies from the 1949 edition, and they said that Sanskrit is quite old, the alphabet associated with it. The characters are drawn differently now. But they knew exactly what was being said. They could read it easily, they said. But that it was script or the font that we use nowadays may not have all of the, we may not be able to exactly create it. So I asked them to do it, and they gave us all back this text in font form. And even then, there's differences between what Sri Yukteswar has. So, long story. There's so much to do with this type of thing, and it's all a labor of love, but it's mostly an education. So we'll review this a little bit next time, and we'll do the final conclusion next time. So as you can see, conclusion is quite short, and we'll do a final review of everything at that time. It's 8:30, I see. So let's close for now. Say our closing prayer. Oh, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet and surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am he. peace, this. Amen. Play a little music on our way out.
Life blossoms like the rose when it unfolds its hidden beauty, shedding around its low fragrance. When it grows from the tender bud, if the frost of hate withers its infant innocence and mars its face, the aim of life's lovely play is lost in wanton pain and sorrow. So awake, O life, from the dream.